For Parshas Toldos, obviously the main issue of this parsha is the brachos that Yitzchak bestows upon Esau. Is that correct? No, yeah. That's not correct. He thinks it's Esau, right? But actually, it's the brachos that he bestows upon Yaakov. And obviously, this is one of the most difficult parshiyos in the Torah from many perspectives, not the least of which, how did Yitzchak in his own mind, you know, believe, or why did he believe that the brachos belong to Esau? And if he had any doubts about it, maybe he should have conferred with his wife Rivka. And the second most difficult problem is how Yaakov takes these brachos. And Yaakov represents, he personifies the mid of Emes. And yet here, in this context, it's anything but Emes. The plot grows thicker, as we'll soon see, because the Chazal see, we'll see in a pasuk in Tanakh that talks about Emes as a reference to Yaakov Avinu, according to Chazal, and Dafka in this context of taking the brachas from Esau. Because when he shows up in front of his father Yitzchak, and Yitzchak asks him, "Are you Esau, the Bechor?" So he gives a very strange answer. He says, he doesn't say, "I am Esau." You know, he says, "Anochi Esau." He says, "Anochi Esau Bechorecha." And Chazal worked very hard to push into this the mid of Yaakov Avinu, the mid of Emes. But of all places, of all contexts, to pin Emes on Yaakov, you know, if you're playing pin the tail on the donkey, I would not use our parsha as the place to pin the tail of Emes onto Yaakov. And yet Chazal, in this very parsha, see to it that we derive Emes from Yaakov. I mean, very, very strange things are going on over here. And obviously, you can learn this parsha over and over again for the rest of your life and still probably never understand what the parsha is all about. In any event, today, what we want to study is what I call a psychological understanding of this parsha. And truth be told, you have to be a profound psychologist to understand this particular approach. And this is the approach of the Hema Yenachamuni, of the Tolna Rebbe. And I think, by way of introduction to his approach, we would really suggest the following, that the human psyche is very complex. And we should never be simplistic. You know, we judge things sort of externally or superficially without delving deeper into the human psyche. And there are many facets to the human psyche. In this particular case, what we're going to do is we're going to raise a number of questions. I think there are 8 questions here that we have to raise. Yeah, 8 questions. And the answer to these 8 questions is going to lie, again, in this presentation. Nobody's forced to accept this. You know, as I always say, there's no religious coercion here. But Torah is very broad. You know, Shivim Panim LaTorah. I personally, I'm not trying to prejudice you, but I find this very, very exciting, meaning I'm not sure if I buy onto the whole thesis from A to Z, but I certainly think that his thesis is worth due consideration and should be taken, weighed quite seriously. So at the end of these 8 questions, the Tolna Rebbe is going to present a thesis about the mind of Yitzchak Avinu. Yeah, this is an analysis, a psychological analysis of Yitzchak Avinu. We're going to send Yitzchak to a shrink, so to speak. I hate to use that term, but because one of my good friends is actually a shrink. He never helps me in any event, but that's a different question. So that the psychiatrists really have to delve into the mind of Yitzchak. So let's go through 8 questions, if anyone's keeping a scorecard here. Michael, do you mind numbering 8 questions as we go through them?
They're down there.
Okay, great. No, but I mean to say, if you can, you know, in our own language, because we tend to give it our own little twist, if you know what I mean. So the first of the 8 questions is the fact that the Torah tells us, and if you have the Chumash here, that you'll see in the blue Chumashim, we are now on page 61. Okay, it's the bottom of page 61. And we're talking about Yitzchak, whose eyesight is certainly hurting. And he calls for Esav, and Esav responds with one word, Hineni, and that's important when we contrast Yaakov's response to the same question. And then the Psukim describe, you know, Yitzchak sending Esav out to the Sodeh for the Shlichus here to get some Matamim. And Rivka, of course, in Pasuk Hey overhears this conversation. And she tells Yaakov that he has to take the brachos. And in Pasuk Ches, she's very outspoken about this. Vata, and now b'ni shma b'koli lasher ani mitzava osach. The word mitzava would indicate what mitzvah kicks in here at this point. To be technical about Harvey, kibud aim. Okay, but it's the same as kibud av, because she's saying, I'm giving you a tzivui. And once a parent gives you a tzivui, you now have a mitzvah of kibud av. In this case, kibud aim. Again, we're going to have to raise the following question. If it's before Matan Torah, then I don't know if there are any mitzvahs, but if there are any mitzvahs, then it should be the seven mitzvahs of Bnei Noach. And included in that list, I looked high and low for Kibud Av Ha'em, and I did not find it. So the Kibud Av Ha'em, from a non-Jewish perspective, is probably what you call optional. It's a voluntary mitzvah, but it's certainly not obligatory. So I'm not sure, and I'll tell you why, because if Yaakov has to make a decision about violating what's called Gnevas Das, we'll discuss what Gnevas Das is all about, Mirtz Hashem, then he would want to weigh the mitzvah of Kibud Aim against Gnevas Das. Now, it could be that Gnevas Das is one of the seven mitzvahs Bnei Noach.
It's a bit extreme.
I don't know if it's so extreme. I'll tell you why. Because Chazal derive Gnevas Das from Gneva. And Gneva is one of the seven mitzvahs Bnei Noach. So it would not be extreme. It would not be so revolutionary to assume, and this has tremendous moral implications for the entire world, that Gnevas Das is applicable even to a guy. Now Yaakov Avinu wants to come forward with the mitzvah of Kibud Aim and say therefore Kibud Aim should trump the mitzvah, or the Iser in this case, of Gnevas Das. I'm not sure how simple that is, especially if you assume that Kibud Aim before Matan Torah is at best voluntary, whereas Gnevas Das, if it's a subcategory of the classification of Gneva, which applies to Bnei Noach, that's obligatory. So to take something that's voluntary and override something that's obligatory, just that, you know, if you're putting on your halachic thinking cap, that's not so simple.
But surely there's an argument in that it's not Kibbutz Aim, because the fact that he's being deceitful to his father, surely that takes...
Correct, excellent. Okay, that's going to be one of the eight questions. Jeremy, you're right on the ball here. I'm very impressed. I just wish you had more time to spend with us, but we'll take what we can get, you know, because you whet our appetites. He's very right here, because this is Kibbutz Av against Kibbutz Aim. And one of the eight questions we're going to see is that if your parents are married, then Kibbutz Av takes precedence over Kibbutz Aim.
Think about the water.
You're correct. They both ask for water. The Gemara says you give the water first to your father, then to your mother. You remember that, Yaakov?
No.
So, yeah, you may remember that. So if you give your father first, that means he takes precedence. Then why does Yaakov Avinu prioritize Kibud Aim over Kibud Av? I mean, it's certainly the rutzon of his father to bring Esav into to get the brachos, not to fool his father. So that's Jeremy's question. It's an excellent question. But I want to bring you to Pasuk Yud Aleph here. Vayomer Yaakov al Rivka Imo, Hein Esav Achi Ish Sa'ir Vanochi Ish Chalak. And, you know, Yaakov presents a very logistical barrier here to Rivka's schedule, to her plan, to her scheme, because no doubt that it's going to be a cinch for Esav, for Yitzhak, even though he's blind, to differentiate between Yaakov and Esav, because surely, you know, Yitzchak is going to want to find out and verify that it, indeed the person in front of him is Sa'ir. You know, he's a hairy guy, which is Esav.
Can't a blind person distinguish a voice?
Oh, beautiful. Now you're all on board here. That's the second out of the 8 questions. So we before we even see the Rebbe's 8 questions, we already got 2 out of 8. And that is Yaakov's question, because there's something called voice recognition. And if I were to tell you, give me a true or false answer to the following question. It's quite possible, quite feasible, that Yitzchak will be able to identify the voice here. Is that true or false?
True.
That's absolutely true. Because we're going to soon see, in a few psukim later, Hakol Kol Yaakov. And this is very strange, because when Yaakov responds to Rivka with his objection, and pointing out that there are barriers here, it's not going to be a simple matter to fool Abba, to fool Yitzchak, because Yitzchak will surely want to touch my body and feel and find out whether I have hair or not. Why didn't Yaakov raise perhaps an even more fundamental question? Whether or not Yitzchak is going to, you know, feel the body of Yaakov and see is it Esav, Esau or not, that's questionable. But one thing is undeniable. I mean, there's absolute certainty about this. Yitzchak will be able to identify my voice. Why doesn't Yaakov Avinu object to Rivka's plan by saying, hey, wait a minute, Yitzchak will certainly identify my voice?
It's also wording, isn't it? The way they express their sentences. Yaakov would say something else, say Baruch Hashem, for example.
Right.
The other one would say...
Right. But that's already a little more subtle. But the voice itself, voice recognition, is very powerful. There's a whole discussion in Hilchos Eidus, you know, whether or not you can give a get based on the fact that the Baal said to deliver this get on his behalf to his wife before he died or whatever it was, and all you have is voice recognition, you can't see his face. So voice recognition is very significant. Now, Rivka's response to Yaakov's objection, which you'll see a little bit later on, Vatikach Rivka in Pasuk Tesvav, where she dresses Yaakov Avinu up in... She dresses him up in the big day chamudos of Esav, correct? And that's fine, but that's well, let's ask our first question. The first question of our 8 questions is, you get the impression from the honest to goodness reading of the psukim, which I call Pshuta Shel Mikra, that had Yaakov Avinu not said a word about this issue, Ulai Yerusheni Avi, if in the absence of that claim, you get the impression Rivka would not have necessarily dressed up Yaakov Avinu in the big day chamudos of Esav. It seems, again, you could always, you know, kvetch a little bit differently, but the straightforward shot is that Rivka's decision to mandate Yaakov to get a hold of these big day chavudas and wear them as he enters into Yitzchak is all a response to Yaakov's objection, if you will. And the question that this is the first of our 8 questions is, I mean, why didn't Rivka think this out from the get-go? You know, it was only when Yaakov came forward and he said, he objected, what's going to happen if he touches me? That's when Rivka comes up with this ingenious idea, this project to be malbish, to dress up Yaakov in Big Day Chamudos. Why didn't Rivka think of this on her own? Question number 2, and that's the question that Yaakov raised before. Yitzchak is no doubt going to recognize the voice of Yitzchak is going to recognize the voice of Yaakov, as he in fact does. Hakol Kol Yaakov Vayadayim Yedei Esav, and that you can see on page 63 in your blue chumashim. And it says there, Vayigash Yaakov El Yitzchak Avi Vayimushehu Vayomer Hakol Kol Yaakov. What's going on over here? Yitzchak says, I'm hearing the voice of Yaakov. Vayadayim Yedei Esav. So then, if Yaakov is worried about all, you know, he's intelligent enough to fit the description of Ezu Chochma Ruas HaNolad, to anticipate what's coming down the line, namely that Yitzchak is going to feel him and he's not hairy like his brother Esav, why didn't he anticipate the voice problem and he's only focused on the Sa'ir problem? That's question number 2. Question number 3 is that, in fact, Yitzchak is very aware of this voice recognition, as we just saw in the Pasuk. And yet in Pasuk Chav Gimel, very odd Pasuk, The Torah says, "Velo hikiro." It's almost as if Pasuk Chav Gimel is coming to answer an obvious question. What question would you ask in the light of Pasuk Chav Beis, Hakol Kol Yaakov? David, can you help me out here? What do you think? What do you think if you wanted to anticipate what Yitzhak should have done at that point after having declared Hakol Kol Yaakov? What do you think his next move should have been?
Are you sure?
Well, let me just stop asking David, and then I'll be right back to your Harvey.
Maybe Harvey's got more of an idea.
Yeah, I'm pressing David here for an answer.
The cat would seem to be out of the bag already, you know.
Correct, and if he has, he's got serious doubts here. Question. Who should he possibly call in now at this point?
Well, Yaakov, maybe.
Well, I don't know about Yaakov, because if Yaakov is the one who's... Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah,
I was thinking of Rivka. Maybe you should call in Rivka, you know. And
get the two brothers there at the same time.
Yeah. Oh, get the two brothers okay, at the same time. Time. In any event, the third question we want to ask is, as you said, David, so well, I mean, maybe you should have called it in at this point, meaning now that Yaakov, I'm sorry, I keep getting the names mixed up here, but you'll bear with me. Now that Yitzchak has recognized the voice as that of Yaakov, at this point, Hakol Kol Yaakov, I mean, he should have dropped the ball. Again, he's basically, Yitzchak, if we want to analyze his mindset, is in a quandary. This is what we call Shnei Ksuvim Machishim Zetzeh. Because on the one hand, you know, he feels the body of this individual and he identifies him as Esav. On the other hand, he hears the voice of this individual and he identifies him as Yaakov. So he's really in a bind. Why is he more willing to rely on the what we call the Mishmush Yadayim than on the Hashmas Kol? And question number four is, how did Yaakov find it in his, you know, in his halachic universe, a permission to violate what we call gnevas das, to fool his father, his blind father, and appear presenting himself as Esav? What's the heter for such a thing? And question number five, if indeed Yaakov did come up with a heter to fool his father, why then in Pasuk Yutes, and again here on the top of page 63, Yaakov's response is to his father, when his father asks him, are you indeed Esav? He says, Anochi Esav Bechorecha. And Chazal put a comma, a pause after the word Anochi. Anochi, Rashi says, Hu amevi lecha, I am whoever I am, and I'm bringing you this food, but Esav Bechorecha. But you just finished telling me that Yaakov is going to fool his father. The whole purpose of this endeavor is gnevas das, and then to say that he goes out of his way to patch it over, you know, and with some sort of flimsy, very flimsy fig leaf, and say this is not a lie because Anochi, yeah, and Esav b'chorecha. And not only that, the Gemara in Makkos, and this is question number six, as I indicated at the outset, has a pasuk in Tillim. It says, "V'dover emes bilvavo lo ragel alishono," which means that he will not lie. A person who's dover emes, even his heart, he's dedicated to truth, he will not lie. Who is that? That's Yaakov Avinu. From this parasha, we're going to prove that he doesn't lie. How do we see that? Because Yaakov comes forward and he objects to his mother, and he says to her, Ula Yerushani Avi, Vayisi Bienov Kimisasea. Correct? And what pasuk is that? Again, that's on page 62. That was pasuk Ches, was it not? Let me just see. Pasuk Yud Beis on page 62. And the strange thing is, if you're looking for some sort of personification of the Isha Emes, the man who's dedicated to truth and doesn't lie, it's very odd to find it in Yaakov Avinu. When Yaakov Avinu is coming in to steal the brachas and present himself as Esav, and simply because he says to his mother, Ulai Yimusheni Avi, therefore he's considered Lo Regel Alashono, the person who doesn't lie. So that's question number six.
Yes.
And we have two more questions on the second page, which if you're on page 88, question number seven, which is of course the greatest, most profound question, is why Yitzchak wants to confer the brachos onto Esav, I mean, does he not realize the difference between Yaakov and Esav? And finally, question number 8, if you take a look at one of the super commentaries on the Torah, the Archaim HaKadosh, on the Pasuk Vatomer Lo Imo, Olai Kiloscha B'ni, says the Archaim HaKadosh, when she says, I'll take the curse, and don't worry about going in, Lech, go in, Kachli, and do what I told you, says the Archaim, Rivka said to Yaakov, that look, you may have a problem here of Gnevas Das, which is prohibited, but on the other hand, there are two other considerations, overriding considerations. Number one, the mitzvah of Kibud Eim, and number two, the fact that I am a prophetess, a Nevi'ah, and I received a prophecy from Almighty God that you have to take the brachas. And those are the two reasons, says the Archaim, for why Yaakov would override the terrible Iser of Gnevas Das and indeed enter in to steal the brachos. So let's take a look at these two reasons of the Archaim HaKadosh, and both of them seem to fail the test. The first reason fails the test because, as we said before, when it's a choice between, a conflict between Kibud Av and Kibud Eim, then Kibud Av takes precedence, takes priority, and therefore to steal the brachos and violate the Isur Gnevas Das, when the will of Yitzhak was clearly stated, he wants to see Esav in there. So with all the respect to Kibud Eim, but Kibud Eim is not great enough to override Kibud Av. And therefore, why does Rivka say you have to listen to me? And the Archaim adds, because of Kibud Eim. What about Kibud Av? Doesn't she realize that Kibud Eim over here loses ground and has to forego to Kibud Av? And not only that, when the second explanation of the Archaim, that she's claiming, well, I'm a prophetess, we have halacha that a prophet is not allowed to tell you to violate an avera except if he's what's called muchzak. Let me just spend a half a minute to explain what muchzak means. You can't just say, well, here's a prophet, the guy identifies himself as a prophet, and he tells you to violate the Torah, you got a prophecy. No, 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 it doesn't work so simple. He's got to be muchzak, he's got to establish himself on the basis of past experience that he had already foretold something, and that came to pass. In other words, his nevuah lahava was this kayemes, and then and only then does the Navi establish himself as a trustable, reliable Navi, such that he can tell me he received a prophecy that requires me to violate the Torah, on a one-shot basis, by the way, not, you know, he can't be oker davar and Torah, completely remove him, but on you know, for Shas Adchak, he can do that. Where do we find, asks the Rebbe, do we find a case where Rivka in the past has established herself as a reliable Navi? I'm not sure so this kasha is, you know, is the strongest of all his 8 questions, because, you know, Yaakov has every reason to trust his mother Rivka, that she's not lying to him. But on the other hand, there are halachas in nevuah, because if Yaakov is going to violate the Isur, the prohibition of Gnevas Das, which we're about to study now, then he needs a definite halachic backbone for such a thing, because Chazal say that the Avos were very meticulous about the observance of the Torah even before it was given, and therefore he would have to know that the halachas of Navi here would apply, which means you have to be a muchzak to a Navi.
Because the issue with Avraham,
wait, just 1 second. I just want to say this. There's a case of Eliyahu HaNavi, I don't want to get off on a tangent here, where Eliyahu HaNavi was able to tell the Jewish people to violate what's called the Isur Shchutei Chutz, again without getting into that, to violate a prohibition of the Torah on a one-shot basis, only because, the Gemara says, as trustworthy as Eliyahu is as a person, that's not enough. But that Eliyahu in the past had already foretold and been established through Chazaka as a true, reliable Navi. But in the case of Rivka, we don't know of any such case that parallels Eliyahu, where she had established herself as a Nevi'ah that could allow or permit the violation of the Torah law. And since the Isur of Gnevas Das, as we said before, is a subcategory, it's a branch. Did I pronounce that right? A branch? Did I get that right? It's a branch of Isur Gezel. I can't say it the way you say it, right? But then the law is that even before the Torah is given, the Isur of Gnevas Das is activated and applies for all of mankind. And therefore, although the mitzvah of Kibud Eim is a great mitzvah, but nevertheless, the mitzvah of Kibud Eim does not have the power to override an Isur of the Torah. For example, if my father tells me to violate the Shabbos, or for that matter, violate any Aver in the Torah, I don't listen to him. I don't know who...
England was there before America.
Oh, okay. Right. It's because before the revolution.
Rivka went to marry Yitzhak. What did happen to the tent? The three miracles. Does that prove anything?
Well, again, you know, it may prove that Rivka is a great tzaddikus and she's wonderful and righteous. Nobody denies that. The piety of Rivka is unquestionable, but her status as a Navi, in this case a Naviyah to be particular, is not yet established. And that's a halachic consideration.
Right. And the other thing is...
You know, that's technical. That's legal.
Did Sarah prove that she was a tzaddikus?
I didn't hear the last word.
What do you say, a prophet? Was it proven?
Sarah, yes. Sarah had proven herself. That's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Avram to listen to Sarah. But let's not get off on a tangent here, because once I start with Sarah, I'm dead meat here. We have we have 4 minutes.
Why did the showdown come so late? They live together. They respect each other. No. You don't go to come into. Why is it discussed here openly? Why is it discussed at home, in the quietness of their own home, without public, without us reading all about it? Look, we have a problem here. You don't know what your son's doing. You don't know what he's doing to your back. He's a good boy, but he's not the right guy to take over the.
Excellent question.
Big business.
Excellent
here.
Question. Maybe at the end of this presentation we'll be able to answer that question. But it's officially not in the canon. You know, it's not in the 8 questions. So we're going to try to see if we can answer the 8 questions, and then maybe we can answer other questions as well. Joel?
I would think that Yitzchak is a greater Navi than Rivka. Just like the Kibbutz Av, Ken is called Kibbutz Aim. If you want to go who's a greater Navi, Yitzchak is the one who's saying this one gets the bracha.
Yep.
Who's Rivka to say
right.
No?
That's a good point. Maybe that strengthens the 8th question. I don't know. Okay. What is Gnevas Das? That's the question that we want to talk about today. Right. Yaakov's not happy.
Okay.
Just a juxtaposition. It got me very nervous, there, Yaakov. You know, I'm hoping I'll answer your question, but I can't guarantee it. You know, I got 8 questions on the table. Right, what is Gnevas Das? So on both sides, there's an entire sugya in Chulin on Daf Tzadi Dalid that deals with Gnevas Das, and we're going to focus on one particular dimension of that sugya. Okay, first of all, this is by introduction. We didn't even get into the kishkas of it. Shmuel in Masech Chulin establishes that the Isur Gnevas Das applies to both a Jew and a non-Jew, which means that you're not allowed to fool even someone who is an Oved Kochav. He can't pull the wool over his eyes. And the Gemara asks, where do we know this from? Did Shmuel make this as an explicit statement? And that's called Lav Mefurish Itmar Ela Mechlola Itmar. And what is Mechlola Itmar? We had a case, and Shmuel delivered a ruling in that case, and from that ruling we can extrapolate what Shmuel's opinion is on Gnevas Daito Shel Oved Kochav. What was the case? Shmuel was crossing a bridge, and he tells Shammai is what we call in Yiddish a Heisbacher, you know, his second in command. He says, go ahead and offer a tip, which is in Hebrew called a manak, to this guy, this non-Jew, who's in charge of the bridge, you know, to make sure that he'll do whatever he because bridges back in the day were very, you know, very dangerous. Now, what happened was, Paisei, this Heisbach, this Shamish, went ahead and he gave a gift to this guy in order to, you know, give him a, what the Arabs call it, the Israelis adopted the word bakshish, you know, to give him a, what's the word in English?
A bribe.
Like a, what do you call it?
A freebie.
A backhander.
Backhander, it's called. And why did Shmuel get upset when his Shamish offered this backhander? And the reason why is because what really the Shamash offered him was non-kosher meat, what's called a Tarnagolas Trefa, but he pawned it off to the guy as a Tarnagolas Shchuta, as if it was slaughtered properly and it was kosher meat.
What difference
it makes? Now, to the guy, it makes no difference whatsoever. So why was Shmuel upset when the Shamash lied and misrepresented this meat? So if you take a look on the top of page 87, you'll see that kosher meat was considered, and even to this day is more expensive than non-kosher meat. If I give you a gift, like let's say for example, there are diamonds that are fake, you know, like what's it called, a zarkuna? Is that pronounced that right? A darconium. Now that I think there are even better imitations. And I tell you that this is a diamond. So the truth is, I'm giving you a gift in any event. I'm not charging you. There's no onah in the strict sense of the term. But that's called gnevas das. Why? Because if I point it off as if it was a real diamond, you know, you owe me a major favor and not just a small favor. And in this case, because a kosher meat was considered, in the Hebrew, it's considered matana meshubachat, it's considered a higher grade of a gift, therefore Shmuel felt that you are being gonev das hagoy. So again, how do we know that Shmuel holds that there's an iser not to steal, so to speak, the das, the understanding, to pull the wool over the eyes of a goy, from the fact that he was makbid on the Shamash, who was in violation of gnevas daito shel goy. Then the Gemara on Omid Beis, in the same Sugya Tzadi Dalet, goes on to tell us a story about Rabbi Yitzchak. Rabbi Yitzchak made a hachroza. How would you say a hachroza in Hebrew?
Proclamation.
A proclamation, an announcement, in front of the Goyim. And he announced that they should come and take meat for free. And in that city, there were many cases where, if let's say the meat was not shechted properly, and it was treif, the Jews would offer it as a gift to the Goyim, to pacify the Goyim. And in this case, what happened was, Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Yosef announced publicly that the Goyim could take this meat. What did they think in their mind? They might have thought that it was kosher meat. He should have notified them that it was non-kosher meat, which is much less of a gift than kosher meat. So the Gemara says that's not called gnevas das. Why? I mean, he's pointing it off as if it might be kosher meat. So the Gemara answers, because all he announced was that he'd come and take this meat. He didn't tell them one way or the other. It's not like the case that we saw with Shmuel and the Shamash, where the Shamash deliberately and explicitly told the gatekeeper, the bridge keeper, that he was offering him kosher meat. Here, the announcement made by Rabbi Yitzchak was that this is meat. If the Goyim want to come along and believe in their mind that this meat is kosher, wow, what a chashuv gift, matana mishubachat, that's called inhu dekamati anafshay. And this, my friends, is the most important distinction in the laws of gnevas das. And listen carefully, it's a very subtle distinction. There are situations in which I do X and you get the misimpression and you think I'm doing you a great, great favor. That's not called gnevas das. If I do X and I tell you that I'm doing it for you and I'm lying through my teeth, giving you the misimpression that I did this great gift and you know, favor on your behalf, that's called gnevas das. Then I'm really explicitly fooling you. But if I present the situation in which you will decide to fool yourself, that's called iu dekamati anafshayu, that is not a violation of gnevas das. Now it could be, as a footnote, that there's something called lifnim mishuras adin, meaning if I want to be really on the up and up and I know that you're going to come to the misunderstanding, then in certain situations it's really recommended that I notify you and set the record straight so that you don't think you owe me a great favor. But technically it's not a violation of gnevas das if the person on the receiving end fools himself and he draws the conclusion on his own. Michael?
And then maybe my case is not quite the same, but I always understood, for instance, if you're selling a house, you have a duty, you can't just keep, if there are defects in the house and you're selling to a non-Jew, you can't just keep quiet about it and just presume that he's going to think it's a good house. You've got to disclose that.
So I don't know, that might depend upon the law of the land, meaning if the law of the land is such that the responsibility to check out the goods is on the buyer, I don't know, every land is different and every law is different, maybe different laws in real estate laws and so on, then you're exempt. You know what I'm saying? Look, here's the house.
Buyer beware.
Buyer beware. You have to pay a company maybe to really do a thorough check. When you buy an automobile, you know, you take it
but
to
I
the...
I thought you had to actually... Sense.
Again, I think it all depends on the law of the land. If the law of the land is such that it's not the responsibility of the lokeach or the buyer, then maybe it's your responsibility in the case of a seller. But in a case of a gift, do you have to, if I'm doing something and you get the misimpression that either A, I did it on your behalf, which I didn't even do it on your behalf, you may have benefited coincidentally, but it wasn't on your behalf, or B, even if I do it on your behalf, but you think it's a gift that's worth 100, but it's only worth 50, so then in that case, if I didn't tell you in any way explicitly to mislead you, if I didn't fabricate the truth, then that's called iu demate anafshayu. He decides to come to the conclusion that it was done on his behalf. And the Gemara demonstrates this. Very fascinating Gemara. This next paragraph, which starts with the word od, is a summary of the most fantastic sugya in Gnei Vastas. So that what normally would have taken us an hour, we're going to do in about 3 minutes. The Gemara tells us a story about Mar Zutra. He was out of the city on his way to come to the city of Mechoza. Okay, now watch what's happening here. Mar Zutra is entering into the city of Mechoza. He's on the outskirts of the city. And just at that moment, Rava and Rav Safra are on the way out of the city. Why are they out of the city? They have business to take care of outside of the city. And sure enough, as luck would have it, they meet each other on the way. And what happens over here? Mar Zutra is so impressed that two great scholars, Kaviyachal, came out to greet him, that he says, "Wow, I am thankful for you for giving me this great honor." Now, what should the Chachamim have done in that case? They were on their way. Should they have to tell him, "Hey, buddy, I want to straighten out the record. We were going there coincidentally. We met you"?
Because they would have deflated him if they'd said, "Actually,
excellent." So Rav Safra, Rav Safra, he opens up his fat trap, pardon the expression, and he tells Mar Zutra, "Sorry to deflate your ego, buddy, but we were on the way and we happened to chance upon you. We had no idea that we were going to meet with you. Had we known, you know, maybe we would have gone out lefodcha, but that's not the case." Later on, again, keep in mind there were two chachamim. Rav Safra was accompanied by Rava. Rava turns to Rav Safra and he says to him, "Why did you do such a thing? Why did you have to offer that information? You caused him chalishus adas." In other words, he initially thought, "Wow, look at that cover that they're giving me. My sister was so impressed. Now, what a deflated ego. They didn't come out to meet me." This is so profound on a psychological level. And we'll see how this sheds a light on the whole story of Yitzchak Avinu with his two sons. In any event, Rava turns to Rav Safra and he says, "Why did you do such a thing?" Meaning, technically, according to the strict letter of the law, you didn't have to notify him. It was iu dekamati anafshe. We never told him that we were out there in order to greet him. He came to that conclusion on his own. That was his own misimpression. And then Rav Safra says, I didn't want to steal, you know, again, you know, technically it would be okay, maybe it's not Gnei Vastas, but at the end of the day, Gnei Vastas. If I wouldn't have said a word, he would have walked away with the misimpression that I came out to greet him. I didn't want to be Gonev Daito. So Rava says to him, "No, this is not Gnei Vastas. Because we never told him that we were coming out for his covid. He came to that conclusion on his own." And this whole psak of Rava is codified by the Shulchan Aruch and Choshev Mishpat, that if a person fools himself when there was no explicit dibur to allow him to draw that conclusion, then there's no Gnei Vastas. If he finds it convenient for himself to believe X because he interprets it in his favor, that's his problem. That's not our problem. We didn't in any way steal his das. And the Shulchan Aruch paskens that even in a circumstance where the Shomea is not convinced by himself because, you know, he feels great about it, but there was some sort of a dibur, the Shulchan Aruch says, "Rak im yesh dibur ha'asur shel gnevas das." Only if the iser was violated explicitly, then there's a violation of gnevas das. But minastam, if the person did not say anything to explicitly confuse the other person, then the Shulchan Aruch says you can rely on our sugya, this gemara that we learned in Chulin about Rav and Rav Safra, that minastam, that's not considered gnevas das. She'ein shumu uravus shal anigna v'daita. When the it's not when is it gnevas das? When is it forbidden? When the nignav, the person on the receiving end, was not fooling himself, right? He was completely relying on what the active gonev hadas was saying. He was fooled by that. That's called gnevas das. But if he himself comes to a mistaken conclusion, and he would rather, you know, accept something which is really non-truth, but he'd rather fool himself in believing it's true, then that's not considered gnevas das. Now we're ready for the psychological analysis of the Tolna Rebbe for the parasha of Rivka and Yaakov. Okay, now you're on the bottom of page 89. Hopefully you have with you page 90, correct? And I'm going to try to move as fast as I can because I know we're pressed for time, but I do want to come to some conclusion here. So on the bottom of page 89, he points out that, again, this is a revolutionary breakthrough here, and you can either accept it or not. As I said, there's no coercion here. Freedom of choice. He begins his whole analysis with the following premise. Fascinating premise. That Rivka knew that Yitzchak himself had not made a full-fledged, definite decision that he wanted to bestow the bracha upon Esav. Why did Yitzchak decide to call in to summon Esav? The answer is that this is what's called Muskal Rishon. Muskal Rishon means, look, I don't know which of the two brothers should really be receiving the bracha. Let's go with Esav. That's my first impression. It doesn't mean that Yitzchak has made an absolute decision. So, Rabbi, I don't know if you can relate to this. Have you ever been in situations where, you know, you made a decision even though you were confused, you had your hesitations, you figured, let me go down this route, but, you know, if down the line somebody would convince me that I made the wrong decision, you know, I'll change my mind.
Most of life.
What?
Most of life
is like that. We're never ever 100% sure. Now, the Rebbe has to convince us that Yitzchak was not sure. That's where we have to hold out our horses here. He says the following. Rivka, therefore, tells Yaakov to go and take the brachos. And what does that mean? That maybe at some point in this whole procedure, in this whole endeavor, Yitzchak is going to really begin to reconsider his decision. Right? Ula yishtachneh, he'll be convinced, levareches Yaakov. Those are the words I want you to underline. In other words, Yaakov is very concerned about gnevas das. And Yaakov is going to go out of his way to make sure that, to the best that he possibly can, that Yitzchak will realize that he is Yaakov and not Esau. Remember, one of the questions, the eight questions we had was, why didn't Yaakov turn to his mother, Rivka, and say, "No, wait a minute, this is an exercise of futility. This is guaranteed, this experiment is guaranteed to fail." Because the first thing that Yitzchak, even before he starts feeling my body, the first thing he's going to do is recognize my voice. And Yaakov doesn't say a word about that. It means that Yaakov really is hoping. Again, we'll try to embellish this and get this on a deeper meaning, but just take it now at face value. Yaakov is really hoping that by using his voice, then Yitzchak will be able to identify his voice, at least to the point in which Yitzchak is in doubt as to whether or not this is Yaakov or Esav. What does Yaakov hope to gain by that? Again, Yaakov is concerned about what prohibition here? Let's go back. About gnevas das. Now, we have an exception to the rule of gnevas das. The exception to the rule of gnevas das is when the recipient, on the other end, convinces himself, he makes the decision, and that's called Iyudika Mate Anafshayu, which is on the top of your page 90. Yitzchak, in Yaakov's dreams and his aspirations, is going to fool himself. He's going to believe that this person in front of him is Esav, right? And even in the heart of Yaakov, he's hoping that Yitzchak will realize that at least maybe this person is not Esav. It might be Yaakov. And that would mean that Yitzchak is going to make a decision, well, look, I don't know who's in front of me. It might be Yaakov, it might be Esav. Kol kol, Yaakov ayadayim yidei Esav. Like there's a Shnei Ksuvim HaMachishim Zedzeh. As we said before, there's a contradiction. So Yitzchak now is in a quandary. And that's what Yaakov is hoping for. That at some point Yitzchak will be in a suffix situation. He doesn't know who's going to be the Mizbarech. Is it in fact Yaakov or is it Esav? The kol on the one hand is a kol Yaakov. Now once Yaakov achieves his goal, that Yitzchak himself has, let's call it, again, this is not the Rebbe, this is Berzon, but just for pedagogical reasons, let's call it a 50% chance that the person in front of me, because it's a kol Yaakov, is indeed Yaakov. If at that point Yitzchak becholzot, afal pichein, decides to make a decision in a 50-50 situation that he wants to bestow the blessings on this unidentified individual, then that's called Iyudika Mate Anafshayu. So again, Yaakov is going to be very careful to avoid sheker, because if he's going to say explicitly to his father Yitzchak that I am Esav, had he said those words Hineni, then it would certainly constitute Gnevas Das, because if Rav Safra and Rav, in that case of Marzutra, had told Marzutra, yeah, we came out to greet you, which was a total fabrication, that would be an absolute head-on violation of Gnevas Das. But if, on the other hand, look, it could be that they came out, you know, coincidentally, you know, two chachamim are very often on trips on behalf of Klal Yisrael or business trips, whatever they do, then Marzutra, in his mind, is in a suffix situation. If he chooses to fool himself and believe that they came out likrato, likvodo, that's Marzutra's problem. That's not an absolute Gnevas Das. And the only violation of Gnevas Das is an absolute sheker. And now he goes into this psychological analysis of the mindset of Yaakov. I'm so sorry, I keep
Yitzchak.
Of Yitzchak. I'm so sorry. I don't know what it is with me today. I apologize. Anyway, we're up to the second paragraph of page 90 that starts with the words Eich. Jeremy, you got to go. Please go. And let's understand Yitzchak on a deeper psychological level. At this point in Yitzchak's life, he's not sure who exactly is in front of him. Who's the Mizbarech now? Is it Esav? Or perhaps it's Yaakov? And yet, oddly, paradoxically, as we ask the question, Yitzchak goes ahead and bestows the bracha. I don't get it. Mimon Efshach. If he wants to be Mivarech Esav and he's afraid that the person in front of him is not Esav, Akolkol Yaakov, then it's his, meaning Yitzchak's responsibility, to clarify who it is. Maybe summon Rivka into the picture or somebody else, I don't know, and decide who's in front of him. If, on the other hand, Yitzchak understands that the one who's standing in front of him is Yaakov, and yet he goes ahead and he gives the bracha, so I don't get it. Initially, Yitzchak wanted to give the bracha to Esav. Why is he changing his mind and giving the bracha to Yaakov? The whole story now, if you grant the Rebbe's premise that Yitzchak is in a state of confusion, he really doesn't know, it's Shnei Ksuvim HaMachishim, who is standing in front of him, then Yitzchak makes no sense. If he believed that it's Yaakov, he should have summoned in Rivka to clarify and verify. If, on the other hand, you know, he knew it was Yaakov, then I don't get it, may Karmika suffer. Initially he wanted to bestow the blessings on Esav. Why is he now magnanimously bestowing the blessings upon Yaakov? And now we're up to the paragraph Omnam. This is the main paragraph of the essay. And he says the following. He gives three examples of people who are in this psychological state of confusion. And he wants to see what's common to these three cases and apply them to Yitzchak. So what are the three cases? Case number one is a person who absolutely is independent. The last thing in the world he wants is to rely on the gifts of others. That's what we call Sonei Matonis Yichya. But you know, sometimes necessity, help me out here, is the mother of invention. I don't know if that's actually the right phrase I need here in this context, but that's my mistake, not yours. What happens when he has no choice? He simply has no choice. His funds have been totally exhausted, and as much as he hates to do it, he has to ask for a gift from someone else. Now imagine his quandary, the psychological bind that he finds himself, and he's knocking on the door of a rich person. What is he thinking? What is he hoping? He's confused. He's hoping, listen carefully, that no one's going to open the door. The Baal Bayis is not to be found. Again, when I say no one opens the door, maybe the maidservant will open the door and will say, my master is out of town. Because deep down inside of him, the last thing he wants is to have to ask somebody for a handout. On the other hand, he's hoping and praying that the Baal Bayis will be there and actually will extend the supportive hand because he desperately needs it. This is the situation of a person who has what we call nigudim levavim. In his heart, he has A and not A at the same time. He is in a very difficult bond. He doesn't know what he really wants. And if you ask him, he doesn't really know what he wants. He gives example number two. A person who needs a medical procedure. And the medical procedure in this case is going to be very, very painful. Okay? So I don't know if he's speaking explicitly about a surgeon, but let's say the surgeon is about to operate on him. Again, if he doesn't put him to sleep, whatever reason, back in the day, I'm not going into that. So what is he hoping? On the one hand, he wants to yell and scream from the pain and hope that the surgeon will stop the surgery midway. I remember when I was a kid, you know, when you went to the dentist, I don't know if anyone here is old enough to remember those days, they didn't give you Novocaine just like this, you know. And then my dentist would say, oh, there'll be only three more drillings. And I knew when he said three, it means nine, you know. And the pain, I can still remember the pain today. Sometimes I walk by and I hear the noise and I remember the pain from my childhood. Mm-hmm. I'm not joking with you, this is true. So on the one hand, you know, I'm hoping the dentist will, you know, get a call or something, it'll stop. But deep down inside, if I'm a mature person, I realize that I need to suffer this pain because without this pain, my life could be, you know, not worth much. He gives a third example. He says, a person gives you a compliment. It's very possible that the person who lavishes this praise upon you is not sincere. For whatever reason, he's being mishabeach you. He's giving you what's called in modern Hebrew a machma'ah, you know, a compliment. But on the other hand, you know, you want to believe it. Inside of you, you know, there's a conflict within. And you don't know whether he means it honestly, sincerely, he doesn't. You know, one part of you wants to believe it, one part of your brain realizes that he doesn't mean it. It's not sincere. So we find ourselves constantly in these psychological Shnayim Ochsim V'Talis situations where we're being ripped apart. And the whole issue of Gnevas Das really boils down to those kinds of situations. And that's what he says in the bottom paragraph. When we get to Yitzchak, Yitzchak is really confused. He's really being ripped apart in both directions. You know, there's some Mefarshim say, oh, Yitzchak believed that Yaakov was a no, you know, he wasn't worth much, you know, he was an Ishtam, Yoshev Oholim, but Esau was the great tzaddik, and it was crystal clear in Yitzchak's mind that Esau was a tzaddik. That's not true. Our perspective is that he knew that Yaakov personifies goodness, he's the Ishtam, Yoshev Oholim, but yet when he looked and keep in mind that Yaakov Avinu was in Beis Lavan for 14 years, and you know Yaakov Avinu learned from Lavan what it means to be a Rami, and Yaakov Avinu also rubbed shoulders with his brother Esau. This is right. But I'm saying that down the line, at some point, this Ish Tam Yoshev Aholim is going to have to learn in the realities of life what it means to be a Rami. And Ramos, at certain points in your life, is absolutely necessary. Esau, on the other hand, if you analyze his personality, is basically evil. On occasion, he hits the mark, you know, and he does something good. So a Yaakov Avinu in his life sometimes is presented with the challenge of Ramos, but that's not the real essence of Yaakov. Yaakov represents Gutzkeit. He represents Emes. Esav is just the exact opposite. He's the symbol of evil, personification of a Rasha. On the other hand, he's an expert when it comes to Kibud Av. Chazal tell us about the level of Kibud Av of Esav. It was unsurpassed. Chazal tells about Reb Shimon Gamliel, this is on the top of your page 91, that he was outstanding in Kibud Av, but he nevertheless admitted that his Kibud Av didn't come to the toenails of the Kibud Av of Esav. And there were other things that Esav did that maybe were worthwhile. But basically, Esav is a Rasha, and Chazal say terrible things about Esav, but yet, you know, a few, how should we say, sparks or of light, you know, flashes of light here, there, and elsewhere, he's able to do it. If you take a look at the Pasuk, if you remember, this is Pasuk Tes, which I think you'll find on page 62, she, Rivka, sends Esav to go out and bring two G'day Ezen. Yeah. And the Medrash sends Yaakov, I meant to say. And these two G'day Ezen represent the two Seirim of Yom HaKippur. Now imagine, on Yom Kippur we bring these two goats, they're identical. One of them is sent La'Zazel, he represents total evil. And the other is sent Bifnim and is brought as a karmel. That's the Seir HaPnimi. That represents total goodness. And basically, the Seir HaPnimi is a representation of Yaakov Avinu because he represents Tam Yoshiva Holim, Mesiris Nefesh. He's willing to go on the Mizbeach. He's a Korban Ola. He's Kodesh Lashem. Esav, on the other hand, represents evil. That's his essence. He's represented by the Seir HaMishtalech that sent off the Tzuk. And no doubt that Rivka is telling Yaakov, she's conveying to Yaakov a subliminal, symbolic message that he, Yaakov Avinu, represents the true goodness, the Seir HaPnimi. That's where the blessing should be bestowed. The Gemara tells us in Masechta Sanhedrin, on the pasuk that says, Vayorach es Reach Begodov, which I think you'll find here on page 63, if I'm not mistaken. Pasuk of Zion, yeah, there it is. Re'e Reach Beni Kereach Asodeh Vayorach Es Reach Begodov. It's very interesting that the Gemara says Al Tikre Begodov El Bogdov, which means that sometimes even the Rishayim amongst Klal Yisrael could reach the level of Kedusha. And we find that Chazal tell us that the Rishayim of Bnei Yisrael, even the most evil people sometimes do good. The Gemara talks about a fellow by the name of Yosef Meshisa. At the time of the Churban HaBayis, the Romans didn't want to go in to steal from the Kodesh, from the Heichal, after they took over the Migdash. They were afraid to go in there. So they looked for a Jew, a culprit, to go in there and steal and take out the menorah. And who offered his services? None other than this guy called Yosef Meshisa. And he went in, and he took out the menorah, the golden candelabra, and then they called on him to go into the Beis HaMikdash a second time and take some other items. And he refused to do so, and he was put to death cruelly. And as he's dying on Kiddush Hashem, he says, Lo dai sheikh asti libori pamachas achisenu pam shnia. In other words, even though he was an evil person, he aided the enemy and he took out the menorah, but yet he was able to be Mekadesh Shem Shamayim. That's the pshat over here. That even when Klal Yisrael become bogdim, even when they become sometimes evil and rebellious, nevertheless, they still are members of Klal Yisrael. And this all connects to the bracha of Yitzchak. According to what we've said, we can understand that Yitzchak Lechatchila wanted to give the bracha to Esav. He believed that Esav had tremendous potential. After all, Esav excelled in the midst of Kibbutz Av, and there were other bright spots on Esav's resume. But yet, at the same time, Yitzchak was confused. He wasn't absolutely certain and persuaded that the bracha should be bestowed upon Esav. After all, Yitzchak appreciated that Yaakov was the Ish Tam Yoshev Oholim. And basically Yitzchak was trying to determine, he was vacillating back and forth, what is the essence of Esav? You know, is it that Esav is essentially evil, just here and there, you know, he went off the derech and he did some good things, or is he essentially Ra? I'm sorry, what did I just say? What I meant to say is Esav essentially good, just that here and there he went off the derech and he did evil things, or no, Esav is essentially evil, even though he does some positive actions from time to time, but his essence is that of evil. And here's where Yitzchak was confused. If Esav is pure evil, then he doesn't deserve the bracha. But if he is basically good, haray, he does some very good things, but sometimes he falls in and he does evil, then he could get the bracha, and the bracha will elevate him. And now what happens? Enter stage Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov enters in. And what happens? The Pasuk says, as we just saw, Pasuk Chaf Zayin on page 63, Re'ei Vayarech Esreach Begodov, somehow Yitzchak, with the smell of Yaakov, smells something from a world called Gan Eden, for another world. And at this point, Yitzchak understands that whoever it is that's in front of him, he doesn't know for sure who it is, but he deserves the bracha. If it's Yaakov, then obviously Yaakov deserves the bracha. If it's Esav, then Esav deserves the bracha. And what's going on here is that although Yaakov, in this case, is, so to speak, guilty of some sort of ramos, but nevertheless, Yaakov Avinu represents this Vayorech Esreach Begodov that we saw in Yosef Meshisa in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, that even when a person does evil, he's still capable of reaching the level of Kiddush Hashem. So that what Yitzchak senses, whether it's consciously or subconsciously, is that since Yaakov, or whoever it is that came in, brings within, you know, brings into him the Reach of Gan Eden, it means he's a person who's willing to be Moser Nafshal Kiddush Hashem. And at the bottom here of page 91, I don't know, it didn't come out so well on my photocopy, I don't know how it came on yours, the B'nai Yisoscher, one of the great Hasidish Rebbeim of Galicia, with regard to Yom HaKippurim, he quotes a Pirkei de Rabbi Lozer about the Shnei Seirim of the two goats of Yom HaKippurim, and they parallel and symbolically represent Yaakov and Esav. V'lachein sholcheinu echad l'srasikal ha'zavet v'samlos Esav shesur rabba sheni v'samlos Yaakov ole kolot mima l'reach nichoch l'ashem. So that the sire apnimi that's brought inside the mizbeach in the heichal, that represents an ola tmima. And who is the ola tmima? Says the Bnei Yisosfer, it's Yaakov Avinu, because he represents the reach nichoch, the reach that we're talking about. So that again, even though Yitzchak Avinu was confused, he was being pulled psychologically in two different directions, his sense was, but not totally convinced, that he should bestow the bracha on Esav, but nevertheless, when Yaakov comes in, and Yitzchak is confused, kol Yaakov, yadam yede Esav, he decides to bestow the bracha on this person. And we asked the question before, mimanavshach, you know, why doesn't he clarify it? He had the verification with this reach of Gan Eden. And Yaakov Avinu had successfully gotten Yitzchak to the point of view where Yitzchak was confused and, you know, was, so to speak, 50-50, and now Yitzchak would have to make the decision on his own. And therefore, on the Pasuk in Tehillim that we spoke about before, Lo Regel HaLashono Zeh Yaakov, identifying as Yaakov, because Yaakov Avinu knows Ramos, but nevertheless, even though he knows Ramos, but he learns how to tiptoe through the tulips, you know, and avoid, you know, walk between the raindrops, and to make sure that he doesn't violate the Iser of Gnevas Das, to say Anochi Esav, but rather Anochi and Esav Bechorecha. He knows on the one hand that he has to wear the begodim of Esav, but on the other hand he knows that he's going to be Mashmir, the call of Yaakov. He's going to bring Yitzchak to the threshold of a confusing situation in which Yitzchak doesn't know who is it that's in front of him. And therefore the ultimate decision as to whether or not to bestow the brachos will be that of Yitzchak. There's no gnevas das here on the part of Yaakov. And therefore Yaakov is considered the Ish-Emes. Yaakov is considered the person who wants to avoid sheker. In other words, he doesn't want to violate gnevas das. Other people would have, you know, wouldn't have reached that level of Yaakov, but his koach is to control his dibur in such a way that it should fulfill the will of God, that it should be halachically acceptable. So Yaakov, although on the one hand he does no doubt receive the brachos through this arma, but on the other hand he was very makpid not to violate the isur of gnevas das. And therefore the Gemara speaks about Dover Emes Bilvavo, the pasuk in Tilin that we mentioned, as referring to Yaakov. And please note that the Gemara in Chulin quotes that very identical pasuk to refer to Rav Safra. And why is that so? So the Shultos, the Rav Achai, says that Rav Safra was in the middle of Kriyat Shema. Somebody came to purchase one of his items and he offered him a sum of money. Rav Safra could not respond because, you remember this, he was in the middle of Kriyat Shema. In the meantime, the person thought mistakenly that he wanted a higher, jack up the price, so he offered him more and more and more. When Rav Safra finished Kriyat Shema, he says, I'm going to sell it to you at the original price because that was my decision in my heart. I had that decision. And that's called Dover Emes Bilvavo. This is Yaakov Avinu. He's the Dover Emes Bilvavo. He doesn't want to do Sheker. He doesn't want to violate Kedevas Das. He wants, in one sense, Yitzchak to be at least confused about who's in front of him, so that ultimately the ball is in Yitzchak's court. He's going to have to decide what to do. We anticipated that Yitzchak at that point would have said, hey, this is confusing. Let's verify what's going on. Let's summon Rivka into the picture. But instead, Yitzchak made a decision that since he was confused anyway, then the Kos of Ashlish, he decided to make this decision based on the Reach of Gan Eden. And therefore, when we go back to the story of Marzucha, with this we'll conclude, Rav Safra was the one who realized that he would create a Chalishas Das to Marzucha if he told him the full truth and nothing but the full truth, namely that they didn't go out Lekrosa. We begin to understand Rav's response, because the pasuk says Dover Emes Bilvavo, and then it says Lo Asa L'Re'ehu Ra. Yes, Rav Safra, I understand that you are a Dover Emes Bilvavo. I understand that you want to make sure that everything that's in your heart that's absolutely true will come out to the fore, and therefore you know it's true that you did not come out from Marzucha. You feel compelled to say that and convey that explicitly to Rabbi Zucha. But nevertheless, look at the end of the pasuk. The end of the pasuk says, Lo asa l're'ehu ra. Rav Safra, you're an Ish Emes, you're totally dedicated to truth. And you're the person who will never sell something while you're Kriyat Shema to a higher price. But nevertheless, there's a limit to that midah of Emes. And what is that limit? When that midah, that attribute of truth, that dedication to truth will violate the feelings and the sensitivities of another Jew, Lo asa l're'ehu ra. This is not a place to be machmir because Dover Emes Bilvavo. In the scale of things, yes, Rav Safra, you're dedicated to Dover Emes Bilvavo. You don't want to hide and conceal the truth. You want Marzucha to know exactly what's the truth. But if there's no Iser of Gnevas Das, and Marzucha came to the conclusion in his decision that this was done lichvodo, don't upset him. Don't undermine his sense of self-dignity. And at the end of this entire presentation, he leaves us with a Musar Haskil. He says a person has to be very careful. On the one hand, he has to be a Dover Emes Bilvavo, but at the same time, he shouldn't be super religious, you know, very pious, and think, well, you know what, there's a Shmek here, an Avak of Gnevas Das. I got to tell him the whole truth, lest he misinterpret it. Don't be more religious than Yaakov Avinu, who was the paradigm of Dover Emes Bilvavo, and yet Yaakov Avinu took the Brachas B'Arma because he didn't technically, according to this presentation, violate the Iser of Gnevas Das. He was very careful never to deliberately, explicitly say something that would indicate that he was Yaakov, that he was Esav, excuse me. And don't be more religious than Rav's claim against Rav Safra, when Rav Safra revealed the truth because he's a Dover Emes Bilvavo and in effect insulted Marzucha. It's like all of things in life, Everything is balancing. Everything comes down to complex situations, complex human relations, human mindset, and psychological sensitivities. Don't always jump the gun. You know, Beis Shammai said, Kala Kimochi, you know, he's unwilling to dance in front of the Kala with Kala Nova Chasuda. And Beis Hillel was very critical of the opinion of Beis Shammai. And he says, no, she needs to hear at that moment in her life that she's a Kala Nova Chasuda. And if that's what she needs to hear, is this no violation of Sheker? Again, the Rishonim talk about many different opinions. Why there's no Sheker if she's not such a beautiful Kala? Maybe she's beautiful. The best answer, I think, is in the eyes of the husband. Use the eyes of the holder. But don't get frum on Yenis Cheshbon, you know? And we had a schmooze here. I don't know, were you here, Michael? Who spoke on at Shalosh Shudis? Just, not this Shabbos, but the one before. I'm trying to remember. Rabbi Oppenheim, who it was the offer of his son, he gave a whole drasha here at Shalosh Shudis about, you know, that some people want to go overboard in their piety, which is okay as long as it's not, you know, stepping on the toes of someone else. So that's how the Rebbe ends this shmooze. Okay, Michael, the floor is yours. I know that you're always the.
I have two problems. I accept fully the Yaakov situation as to what his mindset was and what he was doing. What I can't accept or see from the story is that Yitzchak was in doubt. For two reasons. Number one, if you're in doubt and you know which one to choose, you don't go ahead and tell one of them, go and get the things that are coming and I'll bless you. You bring the idol, like you said, you ask Rivka, or you bring them both.
Wait, Michael, I just want to stop you up front. The Rebbe is not saying he was confused initially. On a deeper level, he may have been confused and he was ripped in two directions because he didn't know how to evaluate Esau. But Yitzchak made a definite decision.
To bless Esau.
The Rebbe's not denying.
Oh, I see.
I'm sorry if I didn't clarify that. At what point in time did Esau become confused? Yitzchak become confused. I'm very consistent in my errors here, at least that much, Kieran. At what point did Yitzchak finally become confused? Not on a deeper subconscious level. At what point did his confusion come from is the depths up to second guessing his original decision? Again, he had an original decision despite his vacillations.
So he chose it.
But at what point did he have a second thought, what we call not Muskel Rishon but Muskel Sheni, and begin to think, you know what, maybe my decision wasn't necessarily the right decision? And he began to get in touch with his own deeper feelings.
When
Yaakov came in, and now Yitzchak realized, wait a minute, I'm not sure who's in front of me. Well, you made a decision. Right. If you're not sure who's in front of you, this is the power of the Rebbe's approach. This is where you buy in or you reject his thesis. But his thesis, if you buy into it, is that if Yitzchak is confused, why doesn't he stop right there?
Yes.
Freeze the frame. And the only answer he can come up with is that Yitzchak at this point is, so to speak, plugging in he's tuning into his own deep feelings. Meaning, a person has different kinds of feelings, and some are less obvious, or more subtle, and more profound, and he's not in touch with them. What a psychiatrist is for, really. You know, to get me... Wait, let me just finish, so I'll see if what I'm saying, if I can convince myself, and then if I can convince myself, maybe I can convince you. The psychiatrist plays the following role. He says, you know what? You want to be this and you want to be that. But wait a second. Are you in touch with your deeper feelings? And that's what the psychiatrist wants to help you, you know, come. The fact that Yaakov, you know, in this wild plan of his, of not being upset about the call Yaakov, on the contrary, he was hoping that Yitzchak would identify that call as a call Yaakov. That's a radical Chiddush. Yes. If you buy into that thesis, then what Yaakov's goal is as a psychiatrist, so to speak, is to get Yitzchak to tune in, to get back in touch with his own original subtle feelings that were sort of lurking in the shadows, that maybe, you know what, maybe it's Yaakov who should be getting the bronze.
And had he made, and when it came to it, did he know who it was? Had he made the decision?
He made a decision, but a decision out of non-decision. What do I mean? He said to himself the following. Correct. Here's the Reich Nichoch. The Reich Nichoch is saying to me the following. This is a very negation that whoever it is deserves the bracha.
That he's in front of him.
Yeah, because again, Michael, we have to be very careful. If we're going to assume, and this is absolutely incorrect, that Yitzchak knew it was Yaakov, then we're in deep trouble. Because if he knew it was Yaakov, then what's the whole business when Esav comes in?
And he says, "Vayecherad Yitzchak."
Correct. And what does he say to Yaakov? Bachicha v'locha b'mirma. In other words, I was fooled. Right. So there's no question that Yitzchak Avinu was confused. But what we're suggesting is that as far, and this is the chiddush of the Rebbe, as far as the Iser of Gnevas Das is concerned, once we get to that stage where the recipient of your actions, of your, you know, what word am I looking for? Your move towards someone, what's that word? Your protestations, whatever the word I'm looking for is, it's not coming to me now. When the recipient of those moves has gotten to the point of confusion, that's already beyond the boundaries of Gnevas Das. That was Yaakov's goal. Now, what does Yitzchak decide to do? Once Yitzchak becomes, so to speak, in touch with that part of him that said, what am I doing over here? After all, you know, Esav is a closed book. You know, we really don't know who he is. Who is? What are the true colors of this Esav? At that point, since Yaakov is indefinite, you know, this, you know, cut your losses, do damage control. At that point, Yitzchak says, "You know what? I'm going to play this in a kind of come see, come saw kind of way. Let's see how this plays out." Because Yitzchak is now in touch with his confusion about Yaakov. He needs a kosev ashlishi shiachriyam in him. He needs, so to speak, and that's the Reich
Nichoch. But then, okay, then that's it. Then he's made his decision. Then
well, he doesn't know who's getting the bracha. In other words, again, the Reich Nichoch.
But he must think it's Esav because when Esav comes in and says, "I'm here now," Yitzchak thinks, "Oh my God, what have I done?" So he must, at the end of the day, have thought it
that could very well be. That could very well be that the Reich Nichoch convinced him that Esav deserves the bracha. That's right. Possible. I don't know. But whatever it is, it's Yitzchak's decision. And once you agree that it's Yitzchak's decision, a lot of things in this parasha begin to make sense. The piece of the puzzle begin to fit into place. Why is Yaakov so agreeable to Rivka, with all due respect? What about keep it up? Why is he agreeable to Rivka, with all due respect? Is she a tried and true, proven Nevi'ah? And not only that, even if I grant you that there is some sort of mitzvah, or kiyuma mitzvah at least, on the part of Ben Noach to be mechaved his mother, but therefore to violate an explicit one of the seven mitzvahs Ben Noach of Gneva, what's going on over here? It also begins to explain why Yaakov Avinu is considered the paradigm of Emes right here in this parsha. Give me a break with this Anochi Esav Bechorecha. Who are you fooling? Honestly, Michael, I learned that Rashi when I was in what's it called, grade school, you call it? We call it in America elementary school. I was probably in third grade when I heard it. And I must have gone home, I don't remember, and laughed at it. Who are you fooling? But you know, if Chazal are putting so much emphasis on Yaakov Avinu in this context, trying to avoid Sheker, it means that maybe this thesis has some attractability to it. He is trying to avoid Gnevas Das at all costs.
I can see that.
That's real. That's, I think, the most amazing part of this whole thing. The other part, which again, you know, it's up to you if you buy into, is this psychological analysis, the mindset of Yitzchak, where Yitzchak is really pulled apart. He's made his decision to bestow the bracha on Esav. Maybe with Dan Lekav Schus, that he saw such good things in Esav that he figured overall he's a good guy. We know he messed up a lot, but you know, even good guys messed up. And now Yaakov Avinu, by coming into this whole picture, has now, you know, given Yitzchak an opportunity to rethink the whole thing. And Yitzchak ultimately makes his decision on his own. That's the key of keys. Okay, Rabbi Moshe, we'll stop here. I found this very engaging.
Yeah, that was great.